Welcome to Political Rewind. Wow, I don't know. I mean, another day where we have about 3 hours of issues to talk about and about 51 minutes to do it in. So everybody in the studio, talk fast. That means you, Kyle Wingfield, columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Every now and then, we remind people that the AJC likes to show its balance. Indicate which of you are conservative columnists and which of you are the more liberal columnists. You fall under the conservative column. Yes?
That is correct.
All right. How do you feel about being that having that label applied to you?
You know, it's kind of interesting. The label is more consistently applied to me, I think, than to maybe my counterpart on the other side. But you know, we do want everyone out there to know that we have a range of voices
working
on our opinion pages.
Working for balance. Dr. Andra Gillespie is back with us. Of course, she's a political science professor at Emory University. We haven't seen you in too long because you've been working hard all summer, even though aren't professors and teachers supposed to have the summer off, be at the beach?
Yeah, no, tell that to my bosses. They don't think that.
Heath Garrett, Republican strategist, government affairs specialist, works with one of the more prestigious government affairs firms in town. That's another fancier way of saying you're a lobbyist, yes?
Well, I'm glad to be here, Bill. I just remind people that's a First Amendment right. It's right up there with religion.
Absolutely.
And the press.
And Heath, of course, has for many years, I mean, he's worked with a lot of Republican office holders, but of course, he's been affiliated with Johnny Isaacson for a long time. And we're looking forward to hearing everything you can tell us about where your friend Johnny Isaacson stands on the health care bill, which of the provisions he's going to vote for, which against, and all of that, right?
Absolutely.
Okay,
absolutely.
Great. And in the studio with us today for the first time, he's been on the phone on this show, but Jared Yates Sexton, he is a professor of creative writing down at Georgia Southern. But Jared, you also have a parallel career as an independent freelance journalist, writing typically about political issues, government affairs issues for publications like the New York Times. You said the New Republic is another publication you've written for. And you gained a lot of national attention when you were the guy who revealed the creator of that GIF which showed Donald Trump beating up CNN. That really put you on the radar, didn't it?
On some really bad radars. Let's be honest. Yeah, I think that got the attention of a lot of white supremacists who you don't want their attention.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming up and being in the studio today. So let's get right to it because we do have so much to talk about. Kyle, this morning, kind of out of nowhere, the president tweeted a major new policy about the military. He issued a series of tweets. I'm going to read them just so we're all clear on exactly what he said. After consultation with my generals and military experts, please be advised that the United States government will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military. Our military must be focused on decisive and overwhelming victory and cannot be burdened with the tremendous medical costs and disruption that transgenders in the military would entail. Thank you. Kyle, that caught everybody, including the Pentagon and Republicans on the Hill, off guard.
Yes. Believe I read that Defense Secretary Mattis is on vacation this week. This is, you know, the phrasing of these tweets is very formal, I would say, compared to what you often see from the president. So he clearly wasn't just sitting on the couch and decided, you know, let's put this out there. There was some more calculation than that. But, given the reaction, there certainly wasn't the kind of preparation or groundwork laid among members of the Armed Services Committees, those sorts of things, that this was coming.
Senator McCain has already issued a statement saying that he is distressed that a policy like this would be announced on Twitter, but more to the point, saying that because it was a tweet, a series of tweets, it's unclear. What does this mean? Will it mean that the military will no longer accept transgender soldiers? The Obama administration opened the door, of course, for transgender individuals to serve openly. Or does it mean the people who are now serving will be kicked out? Panel, we don't know.
And I think that that's, a big problem with this administration. They do things. And regardless of what you think about these issues and regardless of how controversial they are, it's the fact that there seems to be a lack of forethought that goes into these issues that is galling. Before we talk about the merits of this particular issue and the motivation behind doing this right now and whether or not this is another example of President Trump's transactional politics to try to reach out to a particular group to shore up declining support or controversy given some of the other things that he's been doing, the process issue is important. And I know President Trump wants to, you know, do things differently, but there also has to be a respect for process. From my evangelical background, I'm going to quote scripture, doing things decently and in order. And like nothing is done decently and in order, even if from, you know, a moral standpoint or a conservative standpoint, you support the idea, of not granting rights to LGBT people, which, you know, is another very substantive debate that I think, you know, we should have.
Heath, we do know that some time ago, Defense Secretary Mattis did say he wanted to delay implementation, I guess, of accepting new transgender individuals into the armed services. So there was some groundwork laid for this. But what happens if your folks up on the Hill are caught off guard? I'm sure their offices are getting calls right now. Some in support, but also there have got to be constituents out there who are calling and saying, what the heck is going on? Why is he doing this? And those folks, those poor staffers, have no idea what to say.
Oh, there's no question that every staff woke up this morning and all of a sudden were being inundated with calls about something they may not have even seen on Twitter. Because believe it or not, a lot of people in Washington, D.C. are stopping their reading of their Twitter feed because of this kind of stuff, right? It's insanity from a Republican, strategist standpoint. It's anti-textbook of what you should do in order to achieve a policy goal. You can argue that this is exactly what Trump's been doing. It's what helped him win the election. It's what's helped him, continue to deflate criticism around whatever else is going on. So you never know if there's genius behind what he was doing by rolling this out into the middle of the room while there are 10 other subjects definitely have more importance to the average voter. But what it does do is it takes Republicans who might say there are some complex parts of this issue we should be discussing, right, like Secretary Mattis might have brought forward. Maybe the Obama administration went too far in what they were going to do as far as reasonable accommodation. But at the same point in time, you took these people who might be supportive of a debate on it, and you've now put them on defense like Senator McCain going, this is no way to roll it out.
So, Jared, on this show on Monday, Brian Robinson, Republican strategist, just talked about this notion that many people share, that Donald Trump is crazy like a fox when it comes to his Twitter. He doesn't just shoot from the hip. He actually does these things to divert attention. And I said, I don't think there's a lot to that. I think this is a guy who has impulse control issues. But this tweet today, coming in the middle of all the Jeff Sessions controversy with Russia still a big deal, this does, given what Kyle said about it being so much different in the way it was, this does feel like he may mean it, but it feels diversionary.
Well, absolutely. I don't know if you all saw it, but there was actually a statement released by somebody who got a hold of a White House staffer that said that this is for the 2018 midterms, and this is going to make Democrats own the issue of transgender rights. And I think the thing that we're forgetting in this is there are thousands of people serving proudly in the military who this morning are terrified and they feel awful about how their commander-in-chief is treating them. And I think that's one of these issues that gets overlooked a lot of the time.
I mean, and I don't think the Democrats have any problem owning the transgender rights issue. And so I think, you know, in terms of probably a strategy, sure, I think President Trump has lots of strategies, but it's a question of how well thought out a lot of these strategies are. And I don't think that this is, I mean, and this is certainly reigniting the debate. It is putting it in the kind of simplistic terms that I think, you know, people need to argue about. Because, I mean, the basic premise is that they have to pay for, you know, well, they'll have to pay for hormone treatments under the healthcare plan, but that they'll also be paying for surgery. And that's not necessarily clear that people were joining the army because they wanted subsidized benefits in order to have these types of surgeries. And I mean, you know, when they were talking about this last year in the Obama administration, they were also talking about, you know, at which point, if somebody is in the middle of a transition, do they join the Army then? Or if it's somebody who's already transitioned? So there are all these kinds of issues. And so I think, you know, as we think about these issues in particular, there are people who have moral reasons to disagree with these issues. And if those are your reasons for disagreeing with them, then make it that. But the big issue here is that people oftentimes come up with these other reasons that aren't necessarily based in what their real motivations are, or aren't actually based in sort of good social science about sort of what's going on here.
Well, and to your point about being well thought out, I mean, if the point is to create a wedge issue for the 2018 midterms, then you would want to make sure that your side was ready to be on the proper alignment of the wedge,
some talking
right?
Points and deal with,
and not just John McCain, but Senator Shelby from Alabama. I saw a quote from him this morning to the effect of, "I think anybody who wants to serve ought to be able to serve." So, you do wonder why it's happening. I do think it's interesting that this comes amid the Sessions stuff, just because you did finally start to see, because of that, some of the groups and some of the outlets like Breitbart criticizing the president over that move, and maybe he did feel like he was at risk of losing some of that base that up to now, and after everything he's done that has been controversial with a lot of people, he hasn't seen really any erosion of that base yet. Maybe they thought that there was a possibility of that, and they're trying to shore it up. I don't know, but the idea that it was that well thought out just doesn't ring true in a lot of ways.
The more that I've watched Trump and tried to figure out what is the logic behind the chaos, it really seems like every time that he loses track of something, or he loses his leverage, it seems like then he acts out, right? He drops a bowling ball in the bathtub and he sees where the water goes. And this feels like one of those moments. This is chaos, and it adds to the chaos. And I think that his strategy has always been, when things get rough, I'm going to see what happens if I make them rougher.
Yeah, let me pick up on a couple of things that you've all talked about. Number one, you talked about Richard Shelby and Andre. You know, this notion that maybe this is a good issue for, well, I guess you actually said it, Jared, that this is an issue that sets the stage for the midterms. But Richard Shelby's tweet was, "I think everybody should be able to serve." Heath, when you've got a Republican senator from Alabama saying that,
right,
what does that tell you?
Well, and I think this is one of those issues where a decade ago, I guess I can understand the possible logic of where you're headed in a general election midterm, but I think at most this is a wedge issue within the Republican primary.
There you go.
But not in the general election. So I'm not sure how well thought out the political strategy is, if that's what it is. But there's no question in my mind that and we've said this on the show before, Bill, he's not going to change, right? Anybody in the media, any adult who thinks that his pattern that got him elected is going to change as president is kidding themselves. I tell you to my Republican clients and to my independent clients and even to my Democratic friends, he definitely understands that if it's 7 a.m., he's not getting the attention on the news, right? And this is where the media is complicit with and in holy alliance with him and giving him exactly what he wants. He knows to retweet something by 8 a.m. so that he can generate the controversy that gets him the earned media that he wants. And sometimes it's on purpose, sometimes it's accidental, but he gets it.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Heath. He tweeted about the costs. Here's a 2016 study from the RAND Corporation. You know, they're a nonprofit. They get most of their funding from the U.S. government, from military and national security agency sources. And here's what they said. The cost of gender transition-related health care treatment is relatively low, increasing costs between $2.4 million and $8.4 million annually, which represents a 0.04 to a 0.13% increase in active component healthcare expenditures.
So before I came over here today, I was listening to, I think it's Congresswoman Vicki Haslett of Missouri, who had introduced this, in the House version of the Armed Services Appropriation Bill. And she actually quoted a term of $1 billion. And so, I mean, I think people are arguing about the terms, arguing about what the range looks like. I didn't have a time to sort of look at where she got those numbers from. But what that suggests is that she thinks that people will join the military in order to get subsidized, you know, gender reassignment surgery and hormone treatment. And I mean, the numbers, they don't make sense to me, at least as far as that's concerned. So, you know, again, you know, if you want to disagree with us on moral grounds, then that's fine. But don't start making up stuff in order to justify a position.
Georgia Equality put out a release on this. They issued a statement within the last hour, actually. "We were shocked and disturbed to see today's tweets from President Trump regarding the service of transgender individuals in our armed forces. The U.S. military is the largest employer of transgender people in the world, employing an estimated 15,000 transgender individuals. Coming from a president that ran on the promise of creating jobs, making a move to strip jobs from 15,000 Americans shows the president's true feeling toward LGBTQ people." So before we take a break, that is my question. Jared, does this show us more about how the president feels about the gay and lesbian and transgender community?
You know, I would be remiss to try and apply principles to this president. I think he reacts. I think he tries to win political victories here and there. I actually don't think this is a matter of Democrat versus Republican. This is a matter of a president who has reactions and pushes forward policy, and I don't think it's well thought out. I think in this case, it's not even necessarily his worldview. I think it was what the matter or what the time called for at the moment. That's what this feels like.
Heath, what do you think? You get the last word before we take a break.
Well, I just think this is a great example of we're not talking about legitimate, intelligent arguments about whether or not the government and taxpayers should be paying for transgender type. We're having a debate about the president of the United States, his personality, and a flawed process. And I think that that's true on this issue and all these others. And I think there are legitimate, both moral and intellectual arguments around this issue and how it should be handled by the military and whether or not the military ought to be engaged as a social experiment. However, that's not what's going to happen because of the way this was rolled out.
Okay, we have tweets coming in, and we invite you to tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Brian Robinson said, "Since I was just mentioned on politics, on Political Rewind, let me clarify what I said was Trump should instead use Twitter to push health care reform." Well, thank you for that clarification. But more important, Brian, thank you for listening to Political Rewind, which is now going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment.
Christopher Kimball is bringing his new show, Milk Street Live, to the First Center in Atlanta, September 20th. He'll reveal cooking secrets from around the world, offer taste tests, and invite audience members to join in an onstage cooking contest. Support GPB now, and you'll receive 2 orchestra-level tickets to the show. Attend an exclusive pre-show meet and greet with Christopher Kimball, and receive his newest book, Milk Street, The New Home Cooking. Go to gpb.org/milkstreet. That's gpb.org/milkstreet. And thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. We have got the universities of the state represented. Andra Gillespie of Emory University here in Atlanta. Jared Yates Sexton from down there at Georgia Southern. Thank you for being in the studio for the first time. Heath Garrett is here, and our good friend Kyle Wingfield, we should say.
A UGA grad. I'll just put that in there.
Go Dogs.
You just won Heath over. Your column appears on Thursdays and Sundays in the Dead Tree edition of the paper, but we can also read your stuff online.
That is correct.
Right?
Yes.
Where?
Blog on myajc.com. KyleWingfield.blog.myajc.com.
There you go. John McCain, big name in the news, obviously, since yesterday when he flew back from Arizona where he's been having cancer treatment. He had surgery to deal with a tumor in his brain. The outlook is not terribly hopeful, according to medical experts who know the kind of brain cancer that McCain has. But he needed to be on hand in the Senate when Majority Leader Mitch McConnell called for the motion to move to debate on whatever health care bill it is that they are going to talk about in the next couple of days. And McCain didn't lose an opportunity to make some pointed remarks when he took the floor.
"I hope we can again rely on humility, on our need to cooperate, on our dependence on each other, to learn how to trust each other again, and by so doing better serve the people who elected us. Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them. They don't want anything done for the public good. Our incapacity is their livelihood. Let's trust each other. Let's return to regular order.
All right. We're going to talk about all this in a minute, but let's listen to another part of his remarks.
Let's see if we can pass something that will be imperfect, full of compromises, and not very pleasing to implacable partisans on either side, but that might provide workable solutions to problems Americans are struggling with today. What have we to lose by trying to work together to find those solutions?
He's talking, of course, Kyle, about now that the debate on health care is joined, trying to figure out a way to do something that can bring everybody together. And he called for regular order. Would you explain to our listeners, what does it mean when somebody in the House or Senate says, let's go back to regular order?
Well, let's start with what it isn't. It isn't leadership creating a bill behind the doors of their offices and springing it not just on the public and not just on the minority party, but on their own caucus members shortly before they expect to vote on it. So that's not regular order. I mean, Heath could explain this much better than I, but in general, you're going to go through the committee process.
Yeah.
You're going to have both sides able to raise questions and offer amendments in open hearings, and you're going to have the bill debated.
It's pretty straightforward. Right. It's a basic civics lesson, right?
And then you're going to have, you're going to have, this is done through budget reconciliation, and I don't think Senator McCain said anything about the reconciliation process being used here. Maybe I'm forgetting it, but, you know, in a normal bill, you would have to have the 60 vote threshold to begin debate as well.
Yeah, we should point out that when he calls for regular order, he is talking specifically about the fact that McConnell took this bill behind closed doors, didn't have hearings, didn't have opportunities for people to make input. At the same time, he was also reminding us that the Democrats, in passing Obamacare, although they did, in fact, early on in the process attempt regular order, when it came down to getting that bill passed, they knew the only way they could get what they needed was to go behind closed doors.
I think there are two great, interesting historical points here. Number one, Senator McCain coming on the floor reminds us of Senator Kennedy having to cast the 60th vote to break the deadlock out of the Senate, send it back to the House with no amendments, which is why the Affordable Care Act is flawed, regardless of whether you like it or not. It's not the finished product that President Obama wanted because of the partisanship and the supermajority that Democrats had there. And then I thought it was also extremely historical to watch the most deliberative body in the world vote 50-50 to whether or not to go to debate an issue, right? Let's think about the significance of that. We're not voting on the bill itself. We got 50-50 on whether or not we should even begin the debate to get back to some version of regular order. So many Republicans were upset about the way this was handled behind closed doors, not just Democrats and independents. Now that it is on the floor, it's an open amendment process, and I think we're about to see democracy with a little d start to work a little bit again here. And I do think there's some hope that there is going to be a flawed compromise that neither side likes very much on the political spectrum, but it's going to be an ugly process, which is how it was designed to be.
Yeah, I'm just sad that John McCain has to come in and remind people how this is supposed to work. I found the whole speech very depressing. And then you start thinking about how both sides of the aisle are now engaged in this duplicitous sort of game. They not only have to answer their constituents, they now have to answer to all these special interests. They have to start answering to a cable show host. And I think that's incredible. And for somebody to have to come off of a hospital bed and remind people what they're there for, I think that should be a wake-up call for exactly how large of a problem this is.
I think, Andre, that's an important thing that Jared just said.
Mm-hmm.
Because although McCain was talking about these, in this case, talking about the conservative talk show, the Sean Hannitys of the world, and he was being disparaging of them, but he was really making a point, not about them, but about members who pay too much attention to what they say and fear they're going to be attacked by those conservative hosts for not towing the line.
Well, I mean, it's not just them. I mean, I've certainly been in situations where I've seen people witness the fear of Rush Limbaugh and modify their behavior accordingly. But I think there's also this issue of with the just general 24-hour news cycle, regardless of what you're listening to, you can get kind of, you know, caught up in the specter of in the spectacle of that and not actually kind of like, you know, cut the TV off and do your job. And everybody needs to kind of learn how to cut the TV off and do their job and not always be worried about what the talking heads, you know, being one right now, you know, are saying.
Kyle, let me play another part of McCain's remarks yesterday and get you to react to it.
We are an important check on the powers of the executive. Our consent is necessary for the president to appoint jurists and powerful government officials and in many respects to conduct foreign policy. Whether or not we are of the same party, we are not the president's subordinates. We are his equal.
Sort of a shot across the president's bow, reminding him that there are equal branches of government. Yeah.
Absolutely. And it's one of the things I think you've heard people on the right talk about this during the Obama presidency. You heard people on the left talk about during the Bush presidency. And I think during the Trump presidency, you're maybe starting to see a little bit of a consensus emerge that, okay, everybody across the spectrum has let the executive branch get a little too powerful. And it's really not in anyone's interest. It's not the way that, as Senator McCain said, it's not the way our system was designed. And it doesn't really matter whether you agree with the president or not. It's not a functional way for the Congress or the government as a whole to operate. The real irony here, if I could just add one more thing, the real irony here is you don't have on this issue in particular, healthcare, President Trump pushing a particular and specific agenda. He just wants a bill to sign, and so it is kind of. There's some irony here, but I do think it's an appropriate thing to bring up.
I mean, I think it's also an important thing to add. While, you know, I understand and people have talked for a long time about the rise of the imperial presidency and whether or not that balance between the executive and the legislative branches is a little out of whack. I think what's also particularly troubling in this administration is the perception that the president might not be 100% clear about what his powers are and what checks and balances mm-hmm. are. And so in particular, this is a time to make sure that you have a robust legislature that, even though it's controlled by the same party as the president, also exerts its power and exerts its authority and reminds people of what the framers, you know, intended for this relationship to be in the first place.
So, Jared, for people who have the time to watch C-SPAN over the next few days, we really are going to get a lesson in how the United States Senate works. And what I mean by that, of course, is so yesterday, mid-afternoon, they voted to proceed to debate. And that was a victory. Nobody would question that that was a big victory for President Trump and for Majority Leader McConnell. But then, of course, they went immediately to a broad repeal and replace measure. And the parliamentarian ruled that that bill would not fall under the rules of reconciliation, which meant it would need 60 votes to pass. Not only didn't it get close to 60, that vote went down 43 to 57. So now we're going to go on to a whole series of other measures, which will also allow for amendments to be brought by Democrats and Republicans. If I got this right?
I don't know. I just went colorblind for a second. the past couple days have been a lesson in how it's supposed to work. But I think what we're also losing track of here is, what are we arguing? We're arguing should something be done and whether or not it's a win or a loss. We're not getting into whether or not this actually makes healthcare better for anybody else. As a matter of fact, everybody says it won't. So what we're actually doing is we're saying, can they get something done as opposed to should they and what should it be?
I would take a little bit of an issue with what you... I think it is absolutely correct that there are an awful lot of people on the Hill, Republicans, mm-hmm. who just need something to happen regardless. But Heath, I would also suggest that there are people up there, and it may be that it's the conservatives especially, who have ideological values that they really want to have expressed in the bill. The Ted Cruz amendment being a perfect example of that, I would think.
No, I think that's right. I mean, I think that there are a lot of people who are like, we got to get something done. But, you know, the Tom Prices of the world have serious philosophical grounding in what we're trying to accomplish. There are serious flaws within the Affordable Health Care Act, and we can have a lot of debate on what those are and what whether or not what the Republicans are proposing is a true replacement of it. But sometimes that does get lost in the arcane processes of the Senate. And the other thing is both sides are going to use these amendments to score political points by causing votes to go up that are going to hurt Democrats or Republicans either in their primaries or their general elections. But I do think there's a core group. And I put Senator McConnell in this, and I put some of the Democrats in this group. They're not usually the ones you see on television every night, the Johnny Isaacs and everybody else, that are trying to formulate something that does less harm, does do more good, but you're not going to see them on hear them on talk radio, and you're not going to see them on the cable channels at night.
And just to go back to this, I completely agree that there are people who take their jobs seriously, obviously. One of the bigger problems, though, is that this has become the biggest television show in the world, and there are characters who take up a lot of oxygen who, as a matter of fact, don't believe the government should be in the healthcare business. And so the conversation we don't have is whether or not that's where this should be going. And instead, right. we have these characters who just push this agenda instead of actually talking about the nuts and the bolts of it.
I was up there in Washington a few weeks ago, and one of the things I was struck by is, you know, when you get outside and you're watching the television show, as you say, the focus is all on the bill. What is in the bill? What can the bill do? What will it pass? When you talk to members of the House, senators, staffers, one of the things that they talk about a lot that I feel like we don't necessarily hear about as much is the acknowledgement that the bill can only do so much. This three-phase concept that they talked about early on and then you haven't heard as much about, you know, there's a bill that can go so far, and I think we're going to see how far it can go over the next day or so. There's what Secretary Price can do on the regulatory side. And then there are other pieces of legislation that's where I think you get into the real meat of, okay, how can we actually make the healthcare system better? I think Republicans and conservatives view the first step, repealing as much of the Affordable Care Act as they can, as a prerequisite to that. But I don't think anybody thinks that's the end of it. And so what's really going to be interesting, I think, is there was sort of an operating theory that, well, if we can get past the talk of repeal, and repeal is a done deal, that's when maybe we can talk with Democrats about some ideas that we might all agree on. I don't know if that plays out in reality or if Democrats say, you broke it, you buy it, and we'll litigate this in the 2018 elections. But that is sort of an important piece of this that I think has gotten lost in a lot of the commentary that we've seen about
and
the
I
bill.
Think, I mean, I think that there's some process questions that I think, you know, would come up for that. So if you did repeal, and I think this is part of the reason why this, you know, hasn't worked so far yet, it's a question, given the dysfunction that we see, whether or not a replacement is actually even a viable thing, even if you could get just a simple repeal kind of through. So I think a lot of people wouldn't trust that. There might be some good intentions on the part of some people, but just you can't trust 100 people to be able to kind of walk in lockstep in order to make that thing happen. And then I think there are the larger issues about what falls under reconciliation and what doesn't fall under reconciliation in terms of the types of tweaks that one is able to make. And so, you know, even from, you know, when I'm trying to think about what snippets I'm going to use in my class this coming semester about what floor debate looks like, it's great to see this floor debate. This actually really highlights the importance of committee work. And the importance of hearings, and none of that has been part of this process. So at the end of the day, we still don't have like kind of a public buy-in. We're still not walking people through sort of seeing how the sausage is made enough so that people can understand the logic of what's going on here. And these plans that are being offered from the floor have not necessarily had the same number of eyes on them as would have been
normally. Yeah, they haven't been vetted.
Yeah, and so, you know, this is still really scary.
And we're talking really substantively about this, and we're talking about how this is supposed to work, but meanwhile, we have a two-ton elephant screaming at the process from the White House, right, that has kept this from being a conversation, especially about a topic as large as healthcare. So what we have is we have somebody who's screaming, get something done, I don't care what it looks like, while people are trying to actually make the sausage, so to speak. And so I think we're looking at exactly how much outside forces can affect this, and which is the most important part of it.
So let me give our listeners just a little guidance. Without regard to the many amendments that will be introduced, here are some basic things we think we're going to see brought to a vote between now and McConnell hopes by the end of the week. He'll have a measure to send back to the House. One is partial repeal, which could be done under the Reconciliation Act. And under that version, It would repeal the coverage provisions in the Affordable Care Act, individual mandate, Medicaid expansion, which, of course, a lot of Republican governors don't want to see happen at all. And it would also eliminate premium subsidies, but it would leave in place insurance market reforms, like they'd have a base level of coverage. That's pretty much the bill that they sent to President Obama that he vetoed in 2015. CBO says that would eliminate 32 million people from having insurance. Then they got this skinny repeal, which would repeal the individual and employer mandates and essentially would not go very far in changing anything, but it would give them something to send back to the House. Is that making sense to everybody here? Yeah? Okay. I just thought we should have some terms here. Heath, yep. David Perdue and Johnny Isaacson both, of course, voted to move to debate. But neither of them, and Isaacson particularly, has not really expressed himself. He's still weighing how he's going to go with votes on these issues.
Well, and I think, you know, obviously, I would take a little deference. There have been a lot of committee hearings over the last couple of years. So it's very rare that anything's coming to the Senate floor that wasn't robustly debated in a Senate committee over the last couple of years. The difference is the media wasn't covering it and the nation wasn't paying attention to that happening, number one. Number two, Senator Isaacson, I think, is open to voting for a lot of the substitutes that are being offered out there. But he always reserves judgment for what actually shows up and is being offered, because Senator Rand Paul or Senator Bernie Sanders reserve the judgment. They could change three words right before it comes to the floor and gut an entire amendment or make it something completely different. So I think he's wise in doing that. I think you will see Senator Isaacson and Senator Perdue support either a repeal light or a total repeal all the way down the line and reject a lot of the Democratic amendments that are trying to preserve and move towards a single-payer system. We know that philosophically they're opposed to. But then it's going to be one of these scoreboards where they're going to have 33 yeses and 27 noes. And look, it's hard enough for me as a former chief of staff to keep up with what they are. I can't imagine the average voter.
Yeah.
And it's going to become, okay, Republicans and Democrats again.
It's a voterama.
All right. That's what we call it.
I got to get into a break. When we come back, poor Jeff Sessions being attacked by the president. Sad.
On the next Fresh Air, Henry Fountain, who covers climate change for the New York Times and is the author of the new book, The Great Quake, How the Biggest Earthquake in North America Changed Our Understanding of the Planet. The 1964 quake in Alaska, magnitude 9.2, unleashed giant waves and resulted in the deaths of 130 people. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back, AJC columnist Kyle Wingfield, Republican Heath Garrett, Dr. Andra Gillespie from Emory University Political Science Department. Are you Dr. Jared Yates Sexton, by the way?
I'm Professor Jared
Yates. Oh, Professor. Sexton. From Georgia Southern, teaches creative writing, but also is an independent freelance journalist. Well, the hits just keep coming with President Trump in the last week attacking his attorney general. And this is the most recent comment he's made about this.
He should not have recused himself almost immediately after he took office. I think that's a bad thing, not for the president, but for the presidency. I think it's unfair to the presidency. I told you before, I'm very disappointed with the attorney general, but we will see what happens. Time will tell. Time will tell.
Kyle, he made those remarks yesterday in a news conference, a joint news conference with the Prime Minister of Lebanon. A couple of interesting notes there, I think. Number one, the first time the president basically used the phrase, I think it's unfair to the president. He said to the president, and he was really criticized for making it so personal, as if somehow he has to be protected. It was interesting that he modified that yesterday. You got to wonder if some of the people on the senior staff said, be careful, you want to make this about the office, not you.
Yeah. Again, you know, to our earlier discussion, to the extent anything is being that orchestrated right now. I think the interesting thing is, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, it's the first time you've seen some daylight at all between this president and some of the institutions that have been backing him. And it's really interesting to see that it comes over, you know, the fate of someone like Jeff Sessions. But I think it's because Jeff Sessions gave President Trump, when he was just candidate Trump, a lot of credibility among conservatives on issues like immigration, crime, and things like that. And the president tried to make a little light of the of Sessions' endorsement of him last year, but I think he's really kidding himself if he really believes that. He was a real keystone, I think, to a lot of conservative support eventually going to him last year.
I've made clear on the show that I am no fan of Jeff Sessions. However, what is happening right now is problematic. It is problematic because of the institutional ramifications of this. And so, again, it underscores the suspicion amongst some people that President Trump does not understand how government operates. And so the reason why it's problematic for him to point out the presidency or the president is the fact that the attorney general is supposed to be insulated somewhat from the presidency. He's not the White House counsel. He is not Mark Cassowitz. He is not supposed to be his personal lawyer. And in this particular instance, Jeff Sessions had to recuse himself because he was involved in what was going on. So Sessions did the ethical thing by recusing himself from this case. And so, you know, being upset about that, you know, doesn't make sense from an ethical standpoint. And it just raises the specter that there may be potential obstruction going on, which is why we have a special counsel in the first place.
You know, Jared Kyle referred to this. We've always assumed that President Trump's going to do everything he can to hold on to his base. He's messaging directly to them and not to the larger American people. And yet, as Kyle referred to it, Breitbart's really angry about this. Rush Limbaugh has weighed in on this. American conservative, all of those conservative voices that thought Jeff Sessions, when he came on board the Trump campaign, it was the first time those conservatives thought, oh, maybe Donald Trump is genuinely a conservative. Maybe he is going to take up our agenda. And now he's alienating them, at least temporarily.
This has been a very stressful marriage between Donald Trump and Republicans. And I think the one thing that we keep seeing is that Trump and his supporters are not necessarily the same thing as the Republican Party. They're inhabiting one body, although they are of two minds. Occasionally, the Republican Party finds use with Donald Trump, and occasionally, they, you know, the Venn diagram of what they believe comes together and they can find action. But this thing with Sessions, he is a tried and true Republican. He has bona fides in the party, and now we're seeing this this split, this chasm, like, widen between him. And I think this is a this shows that problem.
All right, Heath Garrett, right now Sessions is under fire, but the question is anyone in the president's cabinet safe? In fact, in West Virginia, when he shared a stage with our own Tom Price, he said this.
Secretary Tom Price is also here today. Dr. Price, helping to keep millions of Americans strong and healthy as our Secretary of Health and Human Services, and he's doing a great job. And hopefully he's going to get the votes tomorrow to start our path toward killing this horrible thing known as Obamacare that's really hurting us. By the way, you're going to get the votes? He better get them. He better get them. Oh, he better. Otherwise, I'll say, Tom, you're fired. I'll get somebody.
Ha ha, very funny, Heath.
Oh, wow. You know, look, if you're in the cabinet or you're anywhere in that administration, Sean Spicer last week, the Sessions stuff this week, there's no question that most of the other secretaries would tell you, oh, no, we're just glad it's not us, and we're not paying attention, we're not worried. But in the back of their mind, he knows exactly what he's doing. When he said that to Tom Price in a joking manner, it's definitely part of his mentality. And look at what happened to Chris Christie. I mean, there's a history here, and it is troubling. And I'll say it's particularly troubling even as a lawyer, as a Republican. You're right. He's right. Attorney General Sessions didn't have to recuse, but he should have recused. It was absolutely the right thing to do. And if you were going to undermine your attempt to get Russia off the front page, what he's doing is absolutely keeping it on the front page. It doesn't make sense politically either.
So there's a process concern, and then there's a policy concern. So, again, blaming the Secretary of Health and Human Services for a legislative failure when you should have a legislative liaison staff that, you know, helps to shepherd that is problematic. Not that Price isn't involved in this process, but to blame it squarely on his shoulders is problematic. Then there's the issue of doing it in front of a bunch of 13-year-olds that I just find.
Well, this was in West Virginia. This was not. Oh, that was the Boy Scout Jamboree. Yeah. I apologize. You're absolutely right.
Doing
Sorry.
This in front of children, given all the other stuff that he said, that was kind of interesting. Yeah. You know, is also problematic. And, you know, this hasn't been an issue for him yet. His constituency likes the fact that he tells it like it is. But that speech, out of anything, seems to suggest that President Trump is kind of like monotone. He's a kind of a one-note president. Like, he didn't know how to modulate for a group of kids versus, you know, what he did last night, for instance, in Ohio. And it hasn't cost him anything yet, but it might in the future.
I apologize for stepping on your comment, because you're right. It was in front of the Boy Scout Jamboree, and he's taken – boy, the Boy Scouts, the poor Boy Scouts are the ones who've taken all the heat on this. All right. Last night, the president was in Youngstown, Ohio, in front of another rally, and something he said that we'll play in a minute reminded me – of this scene from Steven Spielberg's Lincoln. It is Lincoln talking to his inner circle, members of Congress who he's got to get on board to go out and get votes to pass to support the Emancipation Proclamation, the freeing of the slaves. Let's listen to a little bit of this scene.
We are stepped out upon the world stage now. Now! With the fate of human dignity in our hands. Blood's been spilled to afford us this moment. Now, now, now. And you grousel and heckle and dodge about like pettifogging Tammany Hall hucksters. See what is before you. See the here and now. That's the hardest thing. The only thing that accounts. Abolishing slavery by constitutional provision settles the fate for all coming time, not only of the millions now in bondage, but of unborn millions to come. Two votes stand in its way. These votes must be procured. Get the hell out of here and get them.
Yes, but how?
I am the president of the United States of America, clothed in immense power. You will procure me these votes.
Daniel Day-Lewis as Abraham Lincoln trying to get the amendment through Congress that will abolish slavery. This was Donald Trump last night in Youngstown, Ohio.
Sometimes they say he doesn't act presidential. And I say, hey, look, great schools, smart guy. It's so easy to act presidential, but that's not going to get it done. In fact, I said, it's much easier, by the way, to act presidential than what we're doing here tonight, believe me. And I said, with the exception of the late, great Abraham Lincoln, I can be more presidential than any president that's ever held this office. That I can tell you.
All right. What do we think of the comparison there, panel?
Delusions of grandeur. I mean, that's the only thing that you know, could possibly kind of come up there. You know, and this has come through in the ways that he's talked about stuff. So, yes, he has, you know, issued executive orders. Yes, he has signed minor pieces of legislation, you know, into office, the biggest of which, you know, I would argue would be the Veterans Affairs bill. But, you know, he's spinning that for an audience that loves him, and that's fine. But other people are looking at this and they have very serious questions and serious doubts. And they're people who like decorum and civility and would like to see it in their president.
Kyle?
I think it's showmanship. I think he has his audience. He knows what they want. He knows what they'll react. The reaction is what he wants. I'll respectfully disagree with you earlier, Andre, about a little bit about the audience with the Boy Scouts, just in the 13-year-olds, just in the sense that I think he knew exactly which audience he was speaking to. And if you, as a scout leader, I can tell you, you can get 14-year-olds to cheer for what they're not supposed to cheer for. And I think he knew exactly what he was doing there, which is not to excuse it. I just think he knew what he was doing. I think it's he plays to the crowd and he lives for the crowd's reaction. And I think we see that over and over and over again. And that's the only thing I come back to. But how else do you get that reaction than by saying, well, maybe Lincoln, but nobody else? I mean, it's just vintage Trump, for better or worse.
You know, I reported from a lot of Donald Trump rallies. I've actually heard him say in person that he would be more presidential than George Washington and Abraham Lincoln combined. So maybe he's learning. I don't know. But this is a really rough situation to sit here and listen to him say this. I mean, I understand that there's a certain amount of showmanship, that there's a certain caricature that presidents can lead to, right? They become a character in and of themselves. This is 6 months in. We haven't seen much in the way of progress. We haven't seen much being passed. We haven't seen the country, quote unquote, being made great again. I have a hard time trying to figure out down the road where this leads, and that really concerns me.
All right, I am just about out of time on today's show. The notion of his being a showman. It's interesting. We heard in that speech, of course, that speech was written by a screenwriter, the Lincoln speech, but talking about Lincoln saying that he essentially is the president of the United States of America cloaked in a mighty power, the sort of thing you would say in behind closed doors. You would have never heard Abraham Lincoln say that publicly to a crowd, and the showman, Donald Trump, does. So
different audience.
Different audiences. All right. We are completely out of time. Andra Gillespie, Kyle Wingfield, Heath Garrett, and Jared Yates Sexton, thank you so much for being here today. Really interesting conversation. Of course, we'll be back Friday at 3. By then, we probably will have some really specific details to talk about in terms of what the Senate is doing on health care provisions. I'm sure Mitch McConnell hopes that we will. So we'll be here at 3 o'clock on Friday. Tomorrow at 2 o'clock on Two-Way Street, I encourage you to tune in. Our guest is the great American novelist, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist, Richard Russo. He really burst on the literary scene in 1993 with the publication of Nobody's Fool. Paul Newman starred in the picture based on the book. They became close friends as a result of that movie and went on to make two more movies out of Richard Russo books. And we'll talk a lot tomorrow about his relationship with Paul Newman. He's got a new book out. And we'll talk also about the fact that he's always written about blue-collar, small-town America. And the question for Richard Russo is, what did you understand about the people in those towns that Democrats didn't get during the election last year, and would your characters have voted for Donald Trump? All that and more tomorrow at 2 when we talk to Richard Russo on Two-Way Street. Jenny, Tyler, Olivia, Lisa, thanks for everything you do for this show. See you all tomorrow at 2.